Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Francine Foss and Anish Chagpar. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology, specializing in the treatment of lymphomas. Dr. Chagpar is associate professor of surgical oncology and director of the Breast Center at Smilow Cancer Hospital at Yale New Haven. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This week, Dr. Foss welcomes Dr. David Stern for a conversation about oncogenes in cancer. Dr. Stern is professor of pathology, associate director of shared resources, and leader of the signal transduction research program at the Yale Cancer Center. Here's Francine Foss.
So let's start off, David, a little bit by talking about what your role is in the Cancer Center, your director of shared resources and signal transduction program. Can you tell our audience a little bit about how this whole Cancer Center is structured as far as the research programs?
Yes, I'm happy to. The Yale Cancer Center is a federally sponsored comprehensive cancer center, which serves to promote basic research and applied research that leads to effective new cancer therapies. The National Cancer Institute of the U.S. funds cancer centers all over the United States, and the Yale Cancer Center serves as a gathering point for cancer biologists and cancer clinicians at Yale in order to promote science and translation to the clinic. The Cancer Center does this in a couple of different ways. One way is by fostering research in targeted areas that are especially important for cancer biology. And in this context, I'm leader of the Signal Transduction Research Program. I'll tell you about that in a minute. The second way the cancer centers operate is by promoting activities of core facilities that would be too expensive or too complex for individual cancer investigators to run in their own laboratory operations. At Yale, these include a very large high-throughput DNA sequencing facility, the Yale Center for Genome Analysis. They include a drug company-like high-throughput drug screening center, which is the Yale Center for Molecular Discovery, and other similarly sized core resources that are used by many cancer center investigators. So in my role as Director of Shared Resources, I try to ensure that we have the right portfolio of shared resources at Yale and to ensure that they are operating efficiently and cost-effectively to serve the needs of Yale cancer investigators.
David, can you tell us a little bit about signal transduction? What is signal transduction and how do you go about studying it?
So we now know that the among the fundamental processes that are dysregulated in all human cancers are what we call signal transduction processes. Cancer is fundamentally a disease of having too many cells in one place at one time, and this occurs either because cells are dividing when they shouldn't or they are not committing suicide when they should. In normal tissues and organisms, cell division and cell survival are tightly regulated by the presence of hormones that either stimulate cell division or promote differentiation or protect cells from committing suicide. These hormones are sometimes called growth factors. They work by binding to receptors on the cell surface. And the receptors then actuate a cascade of signals and processes inside the cell that ultimately lead to cell division or survival. Collectively, these processes are known as signal transduction processes, and generally speaking, all human cancers are promoted by excessive activity or inactivity of components of these processes.
So this is a very complicated system that happens within the cell.
It's the parts of the system that operate inside the cell are somewhat complicated, but the basic system is very simple. Cells express many cell surface hormone receptors, which are normally inactive. If a cell is to divide, a hormone will made available at the surface of the cell. It will bind to the receptor on the cell surface, and the receptor then initiates a cascade of signals into the cell. Often in human cancers, there are mutations that either turn the receptor on chronically, even when the hormone isn't present, or turn on some components of the signaling pathways that the receptor normally activates. As a consequence, the cell thinks it should divide when in fact it shouldn't. And these are the processes that are normally upregulated in cancers.
So normally these little messengers are like floating around in the blood system and looking for the right address, so to speak. And if they find the right address, they land on that cell and they tell it to do something. But sometimes the cells decide to go off on their own and do what they want to do, basically. And that's when you get cancer.
Yes, that's very nicely put, Francine. The problem is the cell thinks that it has seen a signal to divide when it actually shouldn't. And this can occur, again, because the receptor is mutated and turned on when it shouldn't be, or the receptor might be overexpressed, or again, one of the proteins normally activated by these receptors has a mutation or other change that causes it to be excessively active.
So a lot of these changes that are happening in cells, are they happening at the level of the DNA being mutated, or are they happening for other reasons? How do we understand that whole process of how a cell becomes a cancer cell?
Well, we do know, and we have known for decades, that cancer is often initiated by mutations which change the actual structure of the DNA and the structure of the proteins that are encoded by the DNA. Now we know that many of those mutations directly affect components of these signaling cascades. So generally speaking, human cancers will often have mutations that change the structure of a receptor or the structure of a signaling protein such that these proteins are active when they would normally be quiet. Likewise, there are other proteins that normally serve to prevent cells from dividing too often or promote cell suicide. And these are proteins, these are mutations that either turn off expression of one of these cancer-breaking proteins called tumor suppressors, or prevent production of one of these growth inhibitory proteins.
So you basically can have two things going on at the same time. You've got some signals that make a cell grow and some signals that make a cell stop growing.
Yes, the cells have their own checks and balances system, much as our society does, and there are many layers of controls to prevent cells from dividing when they shouldn't and to ensure that the organism maintains its proper structure and pattern.
The whole process of cell dividing happens all the time in our body because we have to replace cells that are dying, like in our mouth and in our intestine, where they come and go quickly. So the body does have a normal regulatory system for this.
Yes, and because our bodies have very complex structures, and as you say, they're dynamically regulated, there's a great need to regulate division and differentiation of specific subsets of cells in different places in the body at different times. And that's why all of these regulatory systems exist.
David, how often do you think that these regulatory systems go awry? In other words, are there changes that are happening in our body all the time that we don't know about that don't turn into cancer, or do these always turn into cancer?
Well, we know that mutation itself is a chronic process that occurs in every cell as a direct consequence of metabolic processes. And more mutations can be generated if individuals are exposed to environmental carcinogens, including tobacco smoke or some industrial chemicals. But even without these environmental exposures, cells in the body are constantly encountering changes in their DNA. As a consequence, all living organisms have evolved very complicated systems to repair damage to DNA structure so that these mutations, as they develop, are quickly fixed and hopefully before the cell is divided and pass these changes on to the next generation of cells.
So a lot of people ask the question, how did I get this cancer? What did I do wrong? Why did this happen to me? It's difficult for people to understand, you know, what's happening at the very fundamental level of the cell and how these mutations occur. You mentioned chemicals and tobacco. Are there other risk factors that you know of, other things that might be promoting cancer?
Well, the as you mentioned, unfortunately, a common question cancer patients will have is what they did to cause the cancer. And the answer is that a major component of developing cancer is simply bad luck. Because these processes are occurring constantly in all individuals, and because development of a cancer might take 6 or 12 major mutations, unfortunately, we are all at risk over time for developing cancers. There are additional factors that can play into cancer risk, and as we've discussed, exposure to environmental carcinogens or dietary carcinogens, or especially tobacco smoke, issues that the individual has some control over. Another important behavioral risk that we've learned about recently, including studies at Yale, is tanning in tanning facilities, because we know that exposure to ultraviolet light, which induces tanning of skin, does so by damaging DNA and damaging cells, and this promotes development of skin cancer. So that's another important behavioral area individuals have some control over. Another kind of risk factor is a hereditary risk factor. We know that there are some cancers, fortunately relatively rare, that are in fact inherited from parent to child with varying degrees of risk. And we've learned a lot about cancer processes from studying the nature of individual hereditary cancer-promoting genes.
So, David, you mentioned that a lot of cancers require not one but more than one mutation. So is this a process then that takes years and years to develop a cancer? Is the average cancer something that's happened over time?
Yes, there's very good evidence, for example, from incidence of single large exposures to radiation. The atomic bombings in Japan during World War II are one example, and also changes in the rate of smoking, tobacco smoking, among different populations in this country. And what these exposure studies have told us is that there's often a lag time of between 15 and 20 years between major environmental exposures that promote cancer and the onset of high risk for development of cancers.
Now, I know a lot of people in the audience are probably thinking, is there any way that I can find out whether I have any of these mutations? We talk about a lot about genetic screening on this program. Is there anything available nowadays that would help anybody to know whether or not they have mutations and are at risk?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, fortunately, hereditary cancers are relatively rare in the populations, but certain types of hereditary cancer are more common than others. One example is hereditary mutations in the genes known as BRCA1 and BRCA2 that are associated with high risk over a lifetime for breast cancer. And these now can be routinely screened through genetic counseling centers, including one available at Yale Medical School.
Well, David, we're going to have to take a short break now for a medical minute. Please stay tuned to learn more information about oncogenes and signal transduction in cancer with Dr. David Stern.
It's estimated that nearly 200,000 men in the U.S. will be diagnosed with prostate cancer this year, and 1 in 6 American men will develop prostate cancer in the course of his lifetime. Fortunately, major advances in the detection and treatment of prostate cancer have dramatically decreased the number of men who die from the disease. Screening for prostate cancer can be performed quickly and easily in a physician's office using two simple tests, a physical exam and a blood test. With screening, early detection, and a healthy lifestyle, prostate cancer can be defeated. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers like the one at Yale to test innovative new treatments for prostate cancer. The Da Vinci robotic surgical system is an option available for patients at Yale that uses three-dimensional imaging to enable the surgeon to perform a prostatectomy without the need for a large incision. This has been a Medical Minute, and more information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Francine Foss, and I'm joined today by Dr. David Stern. And we're here discussing oncogenes, signal transduction, and cancer. So, David, we talked a little bit in the first half of the show about these signaling proteins and mutations that happen in cells that, lead to cancer. And we mentioned the word oncogene, but I don't know if anybody in the audience really understands what an oncogene is. Can you explain that word to us?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, we've known for decades that cancer is caused by changes in the DNA or gene mutations. And at that time, before we knew what any of what the genes were that were affected by those mutations, we just called them oncogenes. And oncogene is basically a gene that has, when mutated, promotes development of a cancer. Now, the important thing about identifying and understanding how these genes work is that they can lead to cancer therapies. And as I mentioned earlier, we now know that many human cancers are characterized by mutations, either in hormone receptors or components of the pathways they activate that promote the cancers and led to development of the cancers. And because we understand a lot about these proteins, it's actually possible to devise therapeutic agents that interfere with this excessive activity of the receptors or the pathway proteins. There are a number of examples of this nature involving anti-cancer drugs that are in use in the clinics now. One of the first was a breast cancer drug called Herceptin, which is an antibody that binds to and inhibits a hormone receptor called HER2, which is an important driver of about 20 or 25% of breast cancers. Now, this was one of the first examples of an oncogene-targeted anti-cancer drug, and it illustrates an important point, which is that this drug is very effective on patients who have breast cancers that are associated with high-level expression and activity of this hormone receptor, HER2, but this drug probably won't have much impact on patients with other kinds of breast cancers. Likewise, there is another actually related receptor called the EGF receptor, which is often activated in a subset of lung cancers. And in the minority of lung cancer patients who have tumors that are driven by excessive activity caused by a mutation in the EGF receptor, those patients may benefit from treatment with drugs that inactivate that receptor. And those drugs include a drug called Erbitux, which is an antibody drug that binds to the EGF receptor on the cell surface, and another drug called Tarceva that inactivates the signaling activity of that same receptor. And there are several others, either approved by the FDA or in the therapeutic development pipeline. In both of these instances, again, it's important that the correct therapeutic agent be matched to patients with the right kinds of mutations, because these agents will be largely ineffective on other cancer patients.
So along those lines, how important is it for us to be sequencing these tumors? And we've talked a little bit in other shows on Yale Cancer Center Answers about a lot of the genomic work that's being done now to sequence patients' tumors and patients' DNA. And I'm wondering how important this really is, both now and in the future, to develop other targeted therapies for these mutations.
Yes, right now, thanks to incredible technological developments and reductions in cost in DNA sequencing, we are approaching an era in which it will become possible to determine the DNA sequence of the tumor for every patient that comes in for treatment at cancer clinics. Already at Yale and elsewhere, targeted resequencing is going on so that genes such as the EGF receptor or BRCA1 or HER2 are evaluated by DNA sequencing and other measurements so that the appropriate drugs can be matched. Unfortunately, this is just the beginning of a long, complex process. At this point, only a minority of cancers are associated with mutations for which we have good FDA-approved drugs. And a lot of the activity in the therapeutic development pipeline is bringing out drugs that target more and more of the signaling proteins that we know are potentially important. A second issue is that in some cases, cancers are not associated. We learn from resequencing tumors that we can't always identify mutations that drive these tumors. And then for those patients, it would be difficult to develop or identify the appropriate drug. One of the reasons is that not all cancers are driven by small changes in the DNA that we can recognize and understand, but rather they are driven by larger scale chromosomal changes that may even create new kinds of proteins. And these are areas under intensive investigation in the research community. So for certain genes and drug targets, we know a lot and we can make strong predictions and we have good drugs. For the majority of tumor types, we're often in the learning and evaluation stage.
So, David, you mentioned HER2 and how important that really has been in breast cancer and other cancers as well. But you actually were involved in some of the early research related to the development of HER2. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, I'm always happy to discuss HER2. So when I started in this field was in the 1980s, and at that time was the time when it was just becoming possible to identify human oncogenes. HER2 was actually first discovered as an oncogene, not in humans, but in rat neuroblastomas in Bob Weinberg's lab at MIT, and I joined that project at a time when we knew that certain neuroblastoma cell lines had activity of a gene that was called NU for neuroblastoma, and we also had antibodies that could recognize that protein. And that was really it, and my job as a fellow in the lab was to try and figure out what that protein did. As we learned in the course of my investigations with some of my colleagues in the lab, we learned that the new protein was closely related to the hormone receptor already understood called the EGF receptor. And that already told us a lot about the new protein. And secondly, I found that new could actually be activated by EGF, but that strangely, EGF did not bind directly to the new protein. We later learned that NU, now known as HER2 or ERBB2, is a member of a 4-hormone receptor family, and that within the family, there are 12 different hormones that can activate one or more of the receptors in the family, and that when these receptors are activated, they form complexes with other receptors in the family, and they cross-activate. And that led to much of our early work then at Yale in understanding this somewhat complex hormone receptor system, and it turns out that all 4 of the receptors in this family are involved and important in different human cancers.
At the time you were doing this work, did you envision that HER2 would become a therapy and would make the kind of impact that it's made in breast cancer therapy?
Well, interestingly enough, at the time, we were working on this rat oncogene only as a model system. And that was because at the time we were doing this work, it wasn't known that it was connected with a human cancer. In fact, in parallel to our work on the understanding how this oncogene protein worked, our lab set up a collaboration with another group at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, led by Mark Green. And Mark Green realized that since we were working on a hormone receptor that was exposed at the surface of the cell, it might be a good model system for evaluating whether antibodies could be injected into organisms and block the activity of an oncogenic protein. So working with our lab, Mark Green's lab developed monoclonal antibodies against this rat oncogene product. And then the lab showed that when those antibodies were injected into rats bearing tumors induced by the new oncogene, that these tumors were held in check. Then a few years, and this was actually the first proof of principle that you could control a tumor with injection of an antibody that binds to a hormone receptor. Then about 2 years later, Dennis Slamon's group at UCLA discovered that the human relative of NU, called HER2, is very important in human breast cancer. And at that time, all of the preclinical work that Mark Green's lab had done, that our lab had done, became very relevant and led in part to rapid development of the antibody drug Herceptin by Genentech.
And basically what we do now with Herceptin is it is the antibody, and we inject it into women the same way you did into the mice, and it shrinks their breast cancer tumors. So that's a tremendous story, David, about marrying the basic cancer biology with translational research. And that segues into the next question I was going to ask you, which is, can you tell our audience why basic research in cancer biology is still critical, and how you integrate with on the clinical side of things to bring new treatments into the clinic?
When I first started in cancer research, the collaborations between basic scientists trying to understand cancer biology and genetics and clinicians who were treating cancer patients, these connections were often fairly distant. And that was because we didn't have a conceptual framework or understanding of cancer to identify drug targets quickly. And so there was little common ground for connecting the clinicians, except with the in the areas of genotoxic and radiotherapies. That's changed dramatically now that we understand a lot about the systems that drive human cancers. And nowadays, it's routine even for the basic cancer scientists to work closely with clinical teams, because even cancer genes that are identified in model systems like worms or flies, and certainly rodent and models, often these systems can be connected directly with specific human cancers. So nowadays, scientists like myself, and I still consider myself to be fundamentally a biologist, our lab is working very closely with clinical translational teams in the cancers we're most interested in right now, and those include breast cancer still and melanoma. And also because the signaling systems we study are important in all human cancers, we are beginning to develop collaborative relationships in other cancers, including lung cancer and pancreatic cancer.
You mentioned melanoma, and I know there's a lot of exciting work being done there with new targets as well. Can you speak a little bit about what your role is in that development of those new therapies?
Well, there's great excitement in melanoma, which 5 years ago was regarded as nearly an intractable disease. And that's occurring on two major fronts. One area is in signaling-related drugs. It turns out that about 40% of human melanomas are driven by mutations in a gene called BRAF. And BRAF is one of the components of the signaling chain that's activated by the growth factor receptors that we and others work on. A few years ago, a couple of drug companies became interested in developing therapeutics that selectively target BRAF when it's turned on, and at least two of these agents, one is called Zelboraf, has been FDA approved. And these agents are having great impact on this subset of melanoma patients in the clinic. So one exciting area in melanoma is the development of the signaling-targeted drugs. Unfortunately, a subset of the BRAF-mutated melanoma patients don't respond to this drug, and other patients often develop resistance. So one area we're working on quite a bit is to look for combination signaling therapies that will have an impact on these BRAF-mutated patients. The second area, which will, I'm sure, be the subject of many Cancer Center Answers podcasts, is the development of so-called immunomodulation therapeutic approaches for melanoma. And this work was pioneered by individuals including Liping Chen and our oncologist Mario Schnall, who led some of the clinical trials on PD-1 inhibitors. And these therapies ramp up the immune attack on cancers, including melanoma, and apparently renal cell carcinoma and lung cancer as well.
Dr. David Stern is Professor of Pathology, Associate Director of Shared Resources, and leader of the Signal Transduction Research Program at Yale Cancer Center. If you have questions or would like to add your comments, visit yalecancercenter.org, where you can also get the podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.